This is the story of the original Princess Nittany, after whom the Nittany Mountain, the Nittany Valley, and the Nittany Lion are named. Her story is told in Chapter 10 of Henry W. Shoemaker's book, Juniata Memories, published in Philadelphia in 1916. Shoemaker writes that he heard the story from an old Indian of the Seneca tribe who lived on the Cowdersport Pike between Clinton and Potter counties, but who in his youth had frequented the Juniata area, both for hunting and fishing, and who had taken part in some of its wars. By the end of the 19th century, there were few of the original Indians left in Pennsylvania, and those who remained adopted settler names. This old Seneca called himself Jake Fatty. "The past seemed like present to Jake Fatty," writes Shoemaker. "To him it was as if it happened yesterday. The vast formations of the mountains and valleys, the changes in the climate, the epochs of time. And the Indian race, especially the Eastern Indians at that time, played the most dramatic part. It all seemed so recent and so real to the old Indian." Of all his stories, his favorite was the story of a beautiful Indian princess who was born along the banks of the Juniata River about 500 years ago by Western reckoning. To the Indians, however, this was in the early days of the world, when the physical aspect of nature could still be changed overnight by a fiat, a single word, of the Gitche Manito, or Great Spirit. It was therefore in the age of great and wondrous events. Nittany was the eldest child of Chonehoe, the chief of the tribe in the Juniata Valley. When Nittany was about 18 years old, a great war was waged for the possession of the Juniata Valley. At that time, it was one of the most pleasant and fertile valleys in the world. Its summers were long and not too hot. Its winters were mild. Its gentle streams were abundant with fish, and the wild game was plentiful in the green and verdant forests. The aggressors were powerful and numerous tribes from the south who coveted the earthly paradise of the Juniata Valley. Though Nittany's father and braves under his command fought with all their strength and courage, they were gradually beaten back and forced to retreat northwards over the Seven Mountains and into the great wide plain that was to become the Nittany Valley. At that time, however, the Nittany Valley was not at all as we know it today. The mountain we call Mount Nittany had not yet risen up in its center to break the cold north winds. So this valley was not at all an earthly paradise. It was cold with great gusts of wind at all seasons of the year. And it was only with great work and effort that a living could be wrested from its soil. So Nittany's tribe longed to return to the sweet and mild Juniata. In defeat, Chonehoe had led his family and his tribe over the Seven Mountains to an area just a few miles northeast of the present State College, an area now called the Barrens, but which at that time was the greenest stand of trees in the valley. The father of Nittany, Chonehoe, felt so humiliated by his tribe's defeat and expulsion from the Juniata Valley that his raven-black hair was said to have turned pure white in a single night. Broken in spirit, he soon died. At the time of Chonehoe's death, his eldest son, Wowinape, was too young to become chief. But the tribe needed immediate leadership if it was going to survive. So Nittany was chosen as regent to serve as chief until the eldest son should come of age. After Chonehoe's death, Nittany quickly sized up the needs of the tribe. First, they had to create farms and learn to grow food in the harsher climate of their new home. Second, she had to prepare the tribe to win the next war, for the tribes of the south would soon be attacking again, pushing them ever northward into colder and harsher lands. She set about, therefore, disciplining the entire tribe, teaching them how to build better bows and arrows, better spears, better weapons to fight with, teaching them how to fight cooperatively in groups in order to have a greater effect, and mostly teaching by her own selfless dedication how to sacrifice everything personal for the good of the tribe. Thus, when the Southern Indians again commenced their drive northward, Nittany's tribe was the most disciplined and organized fighting unit on the continent. Nittany, of course, did not want war, but the time came when she could not prevent it. The Southern Indians slowly infiltrated over the Seven Mountains and began making settlements near the Bear Mountains and in some fertile patches of Tussie Knob and Bald Top Mountain. All this was countenanced in peace. But when they murdered some of Nittany's tribe along the stream known as the Karundinha, the patience of Nittany and her tribe was at an end. Meanwhile, Nittany's younger brother was killed in some of the early fighting, and in the face of the threatened war, Nittany was unanimously elected the queen of the tribe, their new chief. She immediately called an assembly of the whole tribe and announced her intention to fight. Every man and boy of the tribe eagerly volunteered. Nittany outlined the strategy. They would first sweep away every incursion of the Southern Indians on this side of the Seven Mountains. They swept down on the settlements of the Southern Indians, butchering every one of them. They pressed onward to the Bear Meadows and then on to the slopes of Bald Top and Tussie Knob. They met the intruders with fire and sword. Then Nittany's tribe crossed the Seven Mountains to the other side. And there they built a powerful cordon of forts all along the southerly slopes of Long Mountain. The Southern Indians, noticing the flames of burning farmsteads and hearing the dreadful stories of the rout from some of the fleeing survivors, took fear that Nittany's tribe would kill them all and retake the Juniata Valley. They decided to send word to the south to plead for more forces to meet the attack led by Nittany. But then the southern tribes took heart again, seeing that Nittany's tribe did not press further south, but instead took cover in the forts they were building along the southerly side of Long Mountain. They mistook this hesitancy for cowardice. They decided not to wait for reinforcements from the south, but to immediately reform their ranks and counterattack. This was exactly what Nittany had planned for. The counterattack of the southern tribes was met in the Laurel Gorge near Milroy and decisively defeated. As a result of their victory, many of Nittany's tribe wanted to move back to the gentle climate of the Juniata Valley. But Princess Nittany said no. The valley we were pushed into has made us strong. Let us not go back to the place that we had lost, but remain in the place that makes us strong. All the braves of the tribe agreed. Let us seek strength rather than weakness, courage rather than comfort. Let us never forget how our new home bonded us together and made us one. So after the Battle of Laurel Gorge, Nittany led her victorious army back across the Seven Mountains into the colder and harsher clime of their newer home. From this day forward, the land around State College was to be the home of Nittany's tribe. In those dimly remote days, the face of the earth was different from what it is today. There was no range of mountains where the Nittany chain now raises its noble summits to the sky. All was a plain, a prairie, clear to the Bald Eagle Mountains to the west, which had only recently come into existence, and that is the subject of another Indian legend, the birth of the Bald Eagles, and clear east to the Tussie Mountain Range. At that time, one could look from the hillock on which Petit Library now stands and see all the way to Center Hall, Spring Mills, and Milheim. As Princess Nittany was leading her army back from this great victory at the Laurel Gorge, an event occurred which inscribed the name of Nittany on the pages of history even more than the military victory itself. As her army approached the center of the plain, near what is now the town of Linden Hall, she and her army were met by a very old and wizened Indian couple. Leaning on staffs in order to present a dignified appearance, nevertheless it was easily seen that age had nearly bent them double. Their weather-beaten faces were as wrinkled as the bark of trees. Toothless and barely able to speak, they addressed the victorious queen. "We are very old," they began. "The winters of more than 100 years have passed over our heads. Our sons, our grandsons, and our great-grandsons have all been killed in the wars of your immortal sire, Chanehoe, and yourself. We are now alone and have had to struggle by ourselves as best we could. It is spring, and we are about to set out a new crop of corn. But for the past 3 years, the north wind has come down and destroyed our crop every time we planted it." They held out their hands, showing only a few handfuls of corn seed. "This is all we have left," they said. "If we plant it, and it is again blown down by the winds from the north, we shall surely starve. We beg of you, would you kindly have your soldiers stop and build for us a windbreak along the northern side of our corn patch? We are too feeble to go into the forest and cut and carry the saplings. Will not our most kindly queen have some of your braves assist us?" Nittany's brave army was tired. They had already marched 25 miles back from the Laurel Gorge. Many were wounded and still bleeding. Many only wanted to see their wives and families as soon as possible to tell them that they were still alive. All this Nittany knew. Nittany smiled on the aged couple. Then she turned to look into the faces of her army. "Soldiers," she called out, "will not 100 of you go into the forest surrounding us and cut enough cedar boughs with brush on them to build a windbreak for these good people?" Tired though they were, her braves were immediately touched by the nobility of their queen. The voices of every brave, even though wounded and tired, called out in unison, "I will!" And the army broke ranks, each running into the forest to find some young cedar boughs to build the aged couple a windbreak. The queen escorted the old couple back to their college and sat with them as her braves returned with green-tipped poles and built a windbreak that would withstand the worst of the north winds. When the work was done, the old couple fell on their knees, thanking Nittany for her generosity and the beneficence of her braves. She could hardly leave them, so profuse was their gratitude. Only a few hours were consumed in granting them what to her and her braves was a simple request. But the story of that day rang down through the ages in the legends of the Indians. As in a single drop of water, one should be able to imagine all the oceans and even the Niagara Falls, so this one incident was made to stand for all the nobility and kindness of the great Queen Nittany. Before she left the old couple, Nittany promised to return when the corn was ripe and enjoy a corn roast with the old couple. When her braves reached the barrens where Nittany lived, great was the jubilation because of the great victory they had won at Laurel Gorge. Bonfires were lighted, and the valley night was almost turned into day by the fires of their celebration. But around all the fires, the stories told were not only of the fight they won, but of the windbreak that they had built. And that, by the way, is the meaning of Nittany, windbreak. And so Nittany the princess had fulfilled her name. And when the summer was ending and the corn was ripe on their stalks, Nittany sent an orderly to notify the aged couple that she would come to their cottage the next evening for the promised corn roast. It was a wonderful, calm, cloudless night with a full moon shedding its bright smile over the plain. Unaccompanied except by her orderly, Nittany walked the 5 miles from the barrens to the cottage of the aged couple near the present-day Linden Hall. As she approached, she could see that the windbreak had been a success. The tasseled heads of tall corn stalks appeared above the hedge of cedars that her braves had built. Smoke was issuing from the open hearth of the hut, and she could smell the corn roasting on the coals. The aged couple welcomed her, and the evening passed by in innocent and supreme happiness. Every summer thereafter, she came to share a corn roast with the aged couple until they passed away. And thus, in unselfishness and generosity of thought and deed, the great queen's life was spent, making her pathway through her realm radiant with love for her people. As her own death approached after many years of leading her tribe, Nittany gave instructions that she was to be buried near the cottage of the aged couple in the center of the valley. And when she died, every person across the entire plain, from the Bald Eagles to the Tussey Mountains and as far as the Karundina, assembled for her funeral. They gathered in the barrens and carried her body, each taking a turn, the 5 miles to Linden Hall. None believed that they would ever again know anyone as great as her, who had given them such an example of a pure soul imbued with goodness. When they reached the middle of the valley, they placed her body in the grave and covered it with a modest mound of soil. Then they commended her soul to the Gitche Manito, the Great Spirit, and then, with tears in their eyes, began the long walk back to their homes. But that night, something strange happened that they would never forget. A darkness came over the plain, blacker and darker than any night they had ever known. Then suddenly the earth began to rumble and shake. Lightning flashed across the darkened skies. They heard the ripping and crushing of rock. The noise of the breaking, twisting, shattering rock became so great that they thought they would all grow deaf. And the shaking of the earth around them made them terrified. It lasted all through the night as they huddled in fear in their cabins of logs and animal skins. When the first light of dawn came, the rumbling stopped, and suddenly they understood what the rumbling and shattering of the rocks was all about. They beheld that a huge mountain had grown up in a single night in the center of the plain, over the grave of Nittany. And then they noticed something else. Instead of the gusting cold winds that always met them when they emerged from their homes, they felt a warm and mild breeze. They realized that the new mountain had risen to temper and break the harsh winds from the north. Then they all knew at once the meaning of it. A miracle, a sign of approval from the Great Spirit, had happened during the night to forever keep alive the memory of Nittany. She who had tempered the winds from the corn patch of the aged couple years before, and the dwellers of the valley that now existed on either side of the new mountain, which all called Nittany in honor of the princess over whose grave it had arisen, awoke to a new and greater pride in themselves, for they, their princess, their tribe, their plain, and now their valleys, had been the special objects of divine notice. And the name of Nittany became the name of the mountain and the valley, and Nittany also became the favorite name to give new female children of the tribe for centuries to come. But none has been more deserving than the Nittany who lived centuries later near the mouth of Penn's Cave. But that is another legend to be told another time.